Lying. Are you familiar with the Order of the Knights Templar?
I've heard of them.
They were founded many centuries ago, soon after the first of the Crusades, and became an elite fighting force of warriors for God. Effectively, they were monks in armour. They took a pledge of abstinence and a vow of poverty. But the years rolled by and their status changed. In time, they became involved in international finance, and very successful they were at it too. Other orders of knights, the Hospitallers and the Teutonic Knights, looked on them askance, and their power began to be a cause for concern, even to kings. They established a base in southern France and planned to form their own state. They paid no taxes, supported their own private army, and began to lord it over everyone. At last, nearly 200 years ago, King Philip the Fair of France moved against them. There was a terrible purge. The Templars were arrested and driven away, massacred, and at last excommunicated by the Pope. But they could not all be rooted out. They had 15,000 chapters throughout Europe. Nevertheless, with their estates and properties annexed, the Templars seemed to disappear, their power apparently broken.
What happened to them? Mario shook his head.
Of course, it was a ruse to ensure their own survival. They went underground, hoarding the riches they had salvaged, maintaining their organization, and bent more than ever now on their true goal.
And what was that?
What is that, you mean?
Mario's eyes blazed.
Their intention is nothing less than world domination. And only one organization is devoted to thwarting them. The Order of the Assassins, to which your father and I have the honour to belong.
Ezio needed a moment to take this in. And was Alberti one of the Templars? Mario nodded solemnly.
Yes. As are all the others on your father's list.
And Vieri?
He is one as well, and his father Francesco, and all the Pazzi clan.
Ezio pondered this. That explains much, he said. There is something I haven't shown you yet. He rolled up his sleeve to reveal his secret dagger.
Ah,
said Mario.
You were wise not to reveal that until you were sure you could trust even me completely. I was wondering what had become of it. And I see that you have had it repaired. It was your father's, given to him by our father, and to him by his. It was broken in a confrontation your father was involved in many years ago. But he could never find a craftsman skilled or trustworthy enough to restore it. You have done well, my boy.
Even so, said Ezio. All this talk of assassins and Templars sounds like something from an ancient tale. It reeks of the fantastic. Mario smiled.
Like something from an old parchment covered in arcane writing, perhaps?
You know of the Codex page?
Mario shrugged. Had you forgotten? It was with the papers you handed over to me.
Can you tell me what it is?
Ezio was somehow reluctant to involve his friend Leonardo in this unless it became strictly necessary. Well, whoever repaired your blade must have been able to read at least some of it, said Mario.
But he raised his hand as Ezio was about to open his mouth.
But I will ask you no questions. I can see that you wish to protect someone, and I will respect that. But there is more to the page than the working instructions for your weapon. The pages of the Codex are scattered now throughout Italy. It is a guide to the inner workings of the Assassin's Order, its origin, purpose, and techniques. It is, if you will, our creed. Your father believed that the Codex contained a powerful secret.
Something that would change the world. He paused for thought.
Perhaps that is why they came for him.
Ezio was overwhelmed at this information. It was a huge amount to take in all at once. Assassins, Templars, this strange Codex.
I will be your guide, Ezio. But you must first learn to open your mind, and always remember this. Nothing is true. Everything is permitted.
Mario would tell him nothing more then, though Ezio pressed him. Instead, his uncle continued to put him through the most rigorous process of military training, and from dawn to dusk he found himself exercising with a young condottieri on the practice ground, falling into bed each night, too exhausted to think of anything but sleep. And then, one day,
"Well done, nephew," his uncle told him. "I think you are ready."
Ezio was pleased. "Thank you, uncle, for all you've given me." Mario's answer was to give the boy a bear hug.
"Your family! Such is my duty and desire!"
"I'm glad you persuaded me to stay." Mario looked at him keenly.
"So? Have you reconsidered your decision to leave?"
Ezio returned his gaze. "I'm sorry, uncle, but my mind is made up. For the safety of Mamma and Claudia, I still intend to make for the coast and take ship for Spain." Mario did not hide his displeasure.
"Forgive me, nephew, but I have not taught you the skills you now have either for my own amusement or your exclusive benefit. I have taught you so that you may be better prepared to strike against our enemies."
"And if they find me, so I will."
"So,"
Mario said bitterly,
"you want to leave? To throw away everything your father fought and died for? To deny your very heritage? Well, I cannot pretend to you that I am not disappointed, highly disappointed. But so be it. Orazio will take you to the convent when you judge the moment to be right for your mother to travel, and he will see you on your way. I wish you buona fortuna."
With that, Mario turned his back on his nephew and stalked away. More time passed, as Ezio found he had to allow his mother enough peace and quiet to pave the way to her recovery. He himself made his preparations for leaving with a heavy heart. At last he set out to pay what he imagined might be his last visit to the convent to visit his mother and sister, before taking them away, and found them better than he dared to hope. Claudia had made friends with some of the younger nuns, and it was clear to Ezio, to his surprise and not greatly to his pleasure, that she was beginning to be attracted to the life. Meanwhile, his mother was making a steady but slow recovery, and the abbess, on hearing of his plans, demurred, advising him that rest was what she still badly needed, and that she should not be moved again just yet. When he returned to Mario's castle, therefore, he was full of misgivings, and he was aware that these misgivings had grown with time. At that period, some kind of military preparations had been going on in Monteriggioni, and now they seemed to be coming to a head. The sight of them distracted him. His uncle was nowhere to be seen, but he managed to track Orazio down to the map room. "What's going on?" he asked. "Where's my uncle?"
"He's preparing for battle."
"What? With whom?"
"Oh, I expect he'd have told you if he thought you were staying, but we all know that that is not your intention."
"Well,
listen, your old friend Vieri de Pazzi has set himself up at San Gimignano. He's tripling the garrison there and has let it be known that as soon as he's ready, he's coming to raise Monteriggioni to the ground. So we're going there first, to crush the little snake and teach the Pazzi a lesson they won't forget in a hurry."
Ezio took a deep breath. Surely this changed everything. And perhaps it was fate, the very stimulus he'd unconsciously been seeking. "Where is my uncle?"
"In the stables."
Ezio was already halfway out of the room.
"Hey, where are you off to?"
"To the stables. There must be a horse for me, too." Orazio smiled as he watched him go. Chapter 7 Mario, with Ezio riding at his side, led his forces to within sight of San Gimignano in the middle of a spring night in 1477. It was to be the beginning of a tough confrontation.
"Tell me again what made you change your mind," said Mario, still much pleased by his nephew's change of heart.
"You just like to hear it."
"What if I do? Anyway, I knew it'd take Maria a good while to recover, and they're safe enough where they are, as you well know."
Ezio smiled. "As I've already told you, I wanted to take responsibility. As I've already told you, Vieri troubles you because of me."
"And as I've told you, young man, you certainly have a healthy sense of your own importance.
The truth is, Vieri troubles us because he is a Templar and we are assassins.
As he spoke, Mario was scanning the tall towers built close together of San Gimignano. The square-built structures seemed almost to scrape the sky, and Ezio had a strange sense of having seen such a view before, but it must have been either in a dream or in another life, for he had no precise memory of the occasion. The tops of the towers were each aflame with torchlight, and there were many other torches visible on the battlements of the town walls and at its gates.
"He's well garrisoned," said Mario. "And to judge by the torches, it looks as if Vieri may well be expecting us. It's a pity, but I'm not surprised. After all, he has his spies just as I have mine."
He paused. "I can see archers on the ramparts, and the gates are heavily guarded." He continued to scan the city.
"But even so, it looks as if he hasn't got enough men to cover every gate sufficiently. The one on the south side looks less well defended. It must be the place he expects an attack to be least likely. So that is where we'll strike."
He raised an arm and kicked his horse's flanks. His force moved forward behind him. Ezio rode beside him.
"This is what we'll do," said Mario, his voice urgent.
"My men and I will engage the guards at the gate, while you must find a way over the wall and get the gate open from the inside. We must be silent and swift."
He unslung a bandolier of throwing knives and handed it to Ezio.
"Take these. Use them to dispatch the archers."
As soon as they were close enough, they dismounted. Mario led a group of his best soldiers towards the cohort of guards posted at the southern entrance to the town. Ezio left them and hurried the last 100 yards on foot, using the cover of bushes and shrubs to conceal his progress until he found himself at the foot of the wall. He had his hood up, and by the light of the torches at the gate he could see that the shadow cast by his hood on the wall bore a strange resemblance to an eagle's head. He looked up. The wall rose sheer above him, 50 feet or more. He couldn't see if anyone was on the battlements above. Slinging his bandolier securely, he began to climb. It was hard, as the walls were of dressed stone and gave few opportunities for footholds, but embrasures near the top allowed him to gain a firm place to lodge himself while he peered warily over the battlement's edge. Along the rampart to his left, two archers, their backs to him, were leaning over the wall, bows drawn. They had seen Mario's attack begin, and were preparing to fire down on the assassin condottieri. Ezio did not hesitate. It was their lives or those of his friends, and now he appreciated the new skills his uncle had insisted on teaching him. Quickly, concentrating his mind and his eye in the flickering semi-darkness, he drew two knives and threw them, one after the other, with deadly accuracy. The first struck an archer in the nape of the neck, the blow fatal in an instant. The man slumped over the crenellations without a whisper. The next knife flew a little lower, catching the second man full in the back, with such force that with a hollow cry he pitched forward into the blackness beneath. Below him, at the foot of a narrow stone stairway, lay the gate. But now he appreciated that Vieri's force was not enough to guard the city with absolute efficiency, for there were no soldiers posted on its interior side. He bounded down the steps, three at a time, seeming almost to fly, and soon located the lever that operated the heavy iron bolts which locked the solid, 10-foot-high oak doors. He pulled it, needing all his strength to do so, for it was not designed to yield to the force of just one man. But at last the job was done, and he hauled on one of the massive rings which were set into the doors at shoulder height. It gave, and the gate began to swing open, revealing as it did so that Mario and his men were just completing their bloody task. Two assassin men lay dead, but 20 of Vieri's force had been sent to their maker.
"Well done, Ezio," Mario cried softly.
So far, no alarm seemed to have been raised, but it would only be a matter of time.
"Come on," said Mario, "silently now."
He turned to one of his sergeants and said, "Go back and bring the main force up." Then he led the way carefully through the silent streets. Vieri must have imposed some kind of curfew, for there was no one to be seen. Once, they almost fell foul of a patsy patrol.
Shrinking back into the shadows, they let it pass, before rushing up from the rear to attack the men and bring them down with clinical efficiency. "What next?" Ezio asked his uncle.
"We need to locate the captain of the guard here. His name's Roberto. He'll know where the area is."
Mario was showing more stress than usual. "This is taking too long. It'll be better if we split up.
Look, I know Roberto. At this time of night, he'll either be drunk in his favourite taverna or he'll be already sleeping it off in the citadel. You take the citadel, take Orazio and a dozen good men with you."
He looked at the sky, which was just beginning to lighten, and tasted the air, which already carried the coolness of a new day in it.
"Meet me by the cathedral before cockcrow to report. And don't forget, I leave you in command of this gang of hooligans."
He smiled affectionately at his men, took his own force, and disappeared along a street that led uphill.
"The citadel's in the northwest of the town, sir,"
said Orazio. He grinned, as did the others. Ezio sensed both their obedience to Mario and their misgivings at having been entrusted to the command of such an untried officer.
"Then let's go," Ezio replied firmly. "Follow me. At my signal."
The citadel formed one side of the town's main square, not far from the cathedral and near the top of the small hill on which the town was built. They reached it without difficulty, but before they entered it, Ezio noticed a number of patsy guards posted at its entrance. Motioning his men to stay back, he approached them, keeping to the shadows and silent as a fox, until he was close enough to overhear the conversation which was going on between two of them. It was clear that they were unhappy with Vieri's leadership, and the more vehement of the two was in full flow.
"I tell you, Tebaldo," the former was saying, "I'm not happy with that young puppy Vieri. I don't think he could aim his piss into a bucket, let alone defend a town against a determined force. As for Capitano Roberto, he drinks so much he's like a bottle of Chianti dressed in a uniform."
"You talk too much, Zohan," cautioned Tebaldo. "Remember what happened to Bernardo when he dared to open his mouth."
The other checked himself and nodded soberly.
"You're right. I heard Vieri had him blinded.
Well, I'd like to keep my eyesight, thank you very much. So we should end this talk. We don't know how many of our comrades feel like us, and Vieri has spies everywhere."
Satisfied, Ezio made his way back to his own troop. An unhappy garrison is rarely an efficient one. But there was no guarantee that Vieri did not command a strong, loyal corps of patsy adherents. As for the rest of Vieri's men, Ezio had learned for himself how strong a commander fear itself can be. But the task now was to gain access to the citadel. Ezio scanned the square. Apart from the small force of patsy guards, it was dark and empty.
"Orazio."
"Yes, sir."
"Will you engage these men and finish them off? Quickly and silently. I'm going to try to get up on the roof and see whether they've got any more people posted in the courtyard."
"It's what we came here to do, sir."
Leaving Orazio and his soldiers to take on the guards, Ezio, checking that he still had sufficient throwing knives in his bandolier, ran a little way into a side street adjacent to the citadel, climbed to a nearby roof, and from it leapt to the roof of the citadel, which was built round its own interior courtyard. He thanked God that Vieri had evidently neglected to post men in the high towers of the houses of the dominant local families which punctuated the town, since from that vantage point they could have surveyed everything that was going on. But he also knew that gaining control of those towers would be the first objective of Mario's main force. From the roof of the citadel, he could see that the courtyard was deserted, leapt down to the top of its colonnade, and from there dropped to the ground. It was an easy manoeuvre to open the gates and to position his men, who had dragged the bodies of the defeated Patsy patrol out of sight in the shadows of the colonnade. To avoid suspicion, they had reclosed the citadel gates behind them. The citadel seemed, to all intents and purposes, deserted. But soon afterwards there came the sound of voices from the square beyond, and another group of Vieri's men appeared, opening the gates and entering the courtyard, supporting among them a thick-set man, running to Fat, who was clearly drunk.
"Where are the gate guards buggered off to?" the man wanted to know. "Don't say Vieri's countermanded me and sent them off on another one of his bloody patrols."
"Sir Roberto," one of the men supporting him pleaded, "isn't it time you got some rest?"
"What do you mean? Made it back here just fine, didn't I? Anyway, night's still young.
The new arrivals managed to seat their chief on the edge of the fountain in the middle of the courtyard and gathered round, uncertain what to do next.
Anyone would think I'm not a good captain, said Roberto, self-pityingly.
Nonsense, sir, said the man closest to him.
Vieri thinks I'm not, said Roberto.
You should hear the way he talks to me.
He paused, looking round and trying to focus before continuing in a maudlin tone.
It's only a matter of time before I'm replaced, or worse.
He stopped again, snuffling.
Where's that bloody bottle? Give it here.
He drank a deep draught, looked at the bottle to assure himself that it was empty, and flung it away.
It's Mario's fault. I couldn't believe it when our spies reported that he'd taken his nephew in, rescued the little bugger from Vieri himself. Now Vieri can scarcely think straight for rage, and I have to face my old compagno.
He looked around blearily.
Dear old Mario. We were brothers in arms once, did you know that? But he refused to come over to the Patsy with me, even though it was better money, better quarters, better equipment, the lot. I wish he were here now. For two pins I'd...
Excuse me, Ezio interrupted, stepping forward.
What? Said Roberto. Who are you?
Allow me to introduce myself. I'm Mario's nephew.
What?
Roberto roared, struggling to his feet and grabbing unsuccessfully for his sword.
Arrest the little tyke!
He leant close so that Ezio could smell the sour wine on his breath. Onions, too.
You know what, Ezio? He smiled. I should be grateful to you. Now that I've got you, there's nothing Vieri wouldn't give me. Maybe I'll retire. A nice little villa on the coast, perhaps.
Don't count your chickens, Capitano, said Ezio. Roberto spun round to see what his men had already discovered, that they were surrounded by assassin mercenaries, all armed to the teeth.
Ah,
said Roberto, sinking down again. All the fight seemed to have gone out of him. Once the Patsy guards had been manacled and taken to the citadel's dungeon, Roberto, provided with a fresh bottle, sat with Ezio at a table in a room off the courtyard and talked. At last, Roberto was convinced.
You want Vieri? I'll tell you where he is. It's all up with me, anyway. Go to the Palazzo of the Dolphin in the square near the northern gate. There's a meeting being held there.
Who is he meeting, do you know? Roberto shrugged.
More of his people from Florence, I think. Supposed to be bringing reinforcements with them.
They were interrupted by Orazio, looking worried.
Ezio, quickly! There's a battle going on over by the cathedral. We better get going.
All right, let's go.
What about him?
Ezio looked at Roberto. Leave him. I think he may have chosen the right side at last. As soon as he was out in the square, Ezio could hear the noise of fighting coming from the open space in front of the cathedral. Drawing nearer, he saw that his uncle's men, their backs to him, were being forced to retreat by a large brigade of Patsy troops. Using his throwing knives to clear a path, he fought his way to his uncle's side and told him what he'd learned.
"Good for Roberto,"
said Mario, barely missing a beat, as he cut and sliced at his attackers.
"I always regretted his going over to the Patsy, but he's turned up trumps at last. Go! Find out what Vieri's up to!"
"But what about you? Will you be able to hold them off?" Mario looked grim.
"For a while, at least. But our main force should have secured most of the towers by now, and then they'll be here to join us. So make haste, Ezio. Don't let Vieri escape!"
The palazzo lay in the extreme north of the city, far from the fighting, though the Patsy guards here were numerous, probably the reinforcements of whom Roberto had spoken, and Ezio had to pick his way carefully to avoid them. He arrived just in time. The meeting appeared to be over, and he could see a group of four robed men making their way to a group of tethered horses. Ezio recognized Jacopo de Patsy, his nephew Francesco, Vieri himself, and, he let out a gasp of surprise, the tall Spaniard who had been present at his father's execution. To his further surprise, Ezio noticed the arms of a cardinal embroidered on the shoulder of the man's cloak. The men drew to a halt by the horses, and Ezio managed to reach the cover of a nearby tree to see if he could catch anything of their conversation. He had to strain, and the words came in snatches.
but he overheard enough to intrigue him. "Then it's settled," the Spaniard was saying. "Vieri, you will remain here and re-establish our position as soon as possible. Francesco will organize our forces in Florence for the moment when the right time comes to strike, and you, Jacopo, must be prepared to calm the populace once we have seized control. Do not hurry things. The better planned our action is, the greater the likelihood of success."
"But, Ser Rodrigo," put in Vieri, "what am I to do with that ubriacone Mario?"
"Get rid of him. There is no way that he must learn of our intentions." The man they called Rodrigo swung himself up into the saddle. Ezio saw his face clearly for a moment, the cold eyes, the aquiline nose, and guessed him to be in his mid-40s.
"He's always been trouble," snarled Francesco, "just like that bastardo of a brother of his."
"Don't worry, padre," said Vieri. "I'll soon reunite them, in death."
"Come," said the man they called Rodrigo. "We have stayed too long." Jacopo and Francesco mounted their steeds beside him, and they turned towards the northern gate, which the Pazzi guards were already opening. "May the Father of Understanding guide us all." They rode out, and the gates closed again behind them. Ezio was wondering whether now would be a good opportunity to try to cut Vieri down, but he was too well guarded, and besides, it might be better to take him alive and question him. But he carefully made a mental note of the names of the men he had overheard, intending to add them to his father's list of enemies, for clearly a conspiracy was afoot, in which they were all involved. As it was, he was interrupted by the arrival of a further squad of Pazzi guards, the leader of which approached Vieri at a run.
"What is it?" snapped Vieri.
"Commandante, I bring bad news. Mario Auditore's men have broken through our last defences."
Vieri sneered.
"That's what he thinks. But see," he waved at the strong force of men around him, "more men have arrived from Florence. We will sweep him out of San Gimignano before the day is done like the vermin he is."
He raised his voice to the assembled soldiers.
"Hurry to meet the enemy," he cried. "Crush them like the scum they are."
Raising a harsh battle cry, the Pazzi militia formed up under their officers and moved away from the north gate southwards through the city to encounter Mario's condottieri. Ezio prayed that his uncle would not be taken unawares, for now he would be severely outnumbered. But Vieri had remained behind, and alone now, except for his personal bodyguard, was making his way back into the safety of the palazzo. No doubt he still had some business pertaining to the meeting to conclude there, or perhaps he was returning to strap on his armour for the fray. Either way, soon the sun would be up. It was now or never. Ezio stepped out of the darkness, pulling back the cowl from over his head.
"Good morning, Messer de Pazzi," he said. "Had a busy night?"
Vieri rounded on him, a combination of shock and terror flickering across his face for an instant. He regained his composure and blustered.
"I might have known you'd turn up again. Make your peace with God, Ezio. I've more important things than you to deal with now. You're just a pawn to be swept off the board."
His guards rushed Ezio, but he was ready for them. He brought down the first of them with his last throwing knife, the small blade scything through the air with a devilish zinging sound. Then he drew his sword and battle dagger and closed with the rest of the guards. He cut and thrust like a madman in a swirl of blood, his movement economical and lethal, until the last, badly wounded, limped away to safety. But now Vieri was on him, wielding a cruel-looking battle-axe he'd seized from the saddle of his horse, which still stood where the others had been tethered. Ezio swerved to avoid his deadly aim, but the blow, though it glanced off his body armour, still sent him reeling, and he fell, letting his sword drop. In a moment, Vieri stood over him, kicking the sword out of reach, the axe raised above his head. Summoning his remaining strength, Ezio aimed a kick at his opponent's groin, but Vieri saw it coming and jumped back. As Ezio took the chance to regain his feet, Vieri threw his axe at his left wrist, knocking the battle dagger out of it and cutting a deep wound in the back of his left hand. Vieri drew his own sword and dagger.
"If you want a job doing well, do it yourself," Vieri said. Sometimes I wonder what I pay these so-called bodyguards for. Goodbye, Ezio.
And he closed on his enemy. The heat of pain had seared through the young man's body as the axe had slashed his hand, making his head swim and his vision white out. But now he remembered all that he had been taught, instinct taking over. He shook himself, and in the moment when Vieri poised himself to deliver the fatal blow on his supposedly unarmed opponent, Ezio flexed his right hand, spreading his fingers up and open. Instantaneously, the mechanism of his father's concealed dagger clicked, the blade shooting out from under his fingers, extending to its full and lethal length, the dull metal belying the vicious edge. Vieri's arm was raised. His flank was open. Ezio plunged the dagger into his side, the blade slipping in without the least resistance. Vieri stood for a moment, transfixed, then, dropping his weapons, fell to his knees. Blood flowed like a waterfall from between his ribs. Ezio caught him as he sank to the ground. "You don't have much time, Vieri," he said urgently. "Now it is your chance to make your peace with God. Tell me, what were you discussing? What are your plans?" Vieri answered him with a slow smile.
"You will never defeat us," he said. "You will never conquer the Pazzi, and you will certainly never conquer Rodrigo Borgia."
Ezio knew he had only moments before he'd be talking to a corpse. He persisted with even greater urgency.
"Tell me, Vieri. Had my father discovered your plans? Is that why your people had him killed?"
But Vieri's face was ashen. He grasped Ezio's arm tightly. A trickle of blood spilled from the corner of his mouth, and his eyes were beginning to glaze. Still, he managed an ironic smile.
"Ezio, what are you hoping for? A full confession?" "I'm sorry, but I just don't have the time."
He gasped for breath, and more blood flowed from his mouth.
"A pity, really. In another world, we might even have been friends."
Ezio felt the grip on his arm relax. But then the pain of his wound welled up again, together with the stark memory of the death of his kinsman, and he was riven with a cold fury.
"Friends," he said to the corpse. "Friends? You piece of shit! Your body should be left on the side of a road to rot like a dead crow. Nobody will miss you. I only wish you'd suffered more.
"Ezio," said a strong, gentle voice behind him. "Enough. Show the man some respect."
Ezio stood and whirled round to confront his uncle.
"Respect? After all that's happened? Do you think if he'd won, he wouldn't have hanged us from the nearest tree?"
Mario was battered, covered with dust and blood, but he stood firm.
"But he didn't win, Ezio. And you are not like him. Do not become a man like he was."
He knelt by the body, and with a gloved hand reached down and closed its eyes.
"May death provide the peace your poor, angry soul sought," he said. "Requiescat in pace."
Ezio watched in silence. When his uncle stood up, he said, "Is it over?"
"No," replied Mario. "There is still fierce fighting. But the tide is turning in our favour. Roberto has brought some of his men over to our side, and it is only a matter of time."
He paused.
"You will, I am sure, be grieved to know that Orazio is dead."
"Orazio?"
"He told me what a brave man you were before he died. Live up to that praise, Ezio."
"I will try." Ezio bit his lip, though he did not acknowledge it consciously. This was another lesson learned.
"I must rejoin my men, but I have something for you. Something that will teach you a little more about your enemy. It's a letter we took from one of the priests here. It was intended for Vieri's father, but Francesco evidently is no longer here to receive it."
He handed over a paper, the seal broken open.
"This same priest will oversee the funeral rites. I'll get one of my sergeants to make the arrangements."
"I have things to tell you." Mario raised his hand.
"Later, when our business here is finished. After this setback,
Our enemies won't be able to move as fast as they'd hoped, and Lorenzo in Florence will be very much on his guard. For the moment, we have the advantage of them. He stopped. But I must get back. Read the letter, Ezio, and reflect on what it says. And see to your hand. He was gone. Ezio moved away from Vieri's body and sat beneath the tree he had hidden behind earlier. Flies were already hovering round Vieri's face. Ezio opened the letter and read. Messer Francesco, I have done as you requested and spoken with your son. I agree with your assessment, though only in part. Yes, Vieri is brash and prone to act without forethought, and he has a habit of treating his men like playthings, like chess pieces for whose lives he shows no more concern than if they were made of ivory or wood. And his punishments are indeed cruel. I have received reports of at least 3 men being disfigured as a result. But I do not think him, as you put it, beyond repair. Rather, I believe the solution to be a simple matter. He seeks your approval, your attention. These outbursts of his are a result of insecurities born of a sense of inadequacy. He speaks of you fondly and often, and expresses a desire to be closer to you. So, if he is loud and foul and angry, I believe it is simply because he wants to be noticed. He wants to be loved. Act as you see fit on the information I've given you here. But now I must ask that we end this correspondence. Were he to discover the nature of our discourse, I candidly fear what might become of me. Yours in confidence, Father Giocondo.
Ezio sat for a long while after having read the letter, thinking. He looked at Vieri's body. There was a wallet at his belt he had not noticed before. He walked over and took it, returning to his tree to examine its contents. There was a miniature picture of a woman, some florins in a pouch, a little notebook that had not been used and, carefully rolled, a piece of vellum. With trembling hands, Ezio opened it, and immediately recognized what it was. A page of the Codex. The sun rose higher, and a group of monks appeared with a wooden stretcher on which they laid Vieri's body, and carried it away. As spring turned to summer again, and the mimosa and azaleas had given way to lilies and roses, an uneasy peace returned to Tuscany. Ezio was content to see that his mother continued in her recovery, though her nerves had been so shattered by the tragedy that had struck her, that now it seemed to him she might never leave the peaceful calm of the convent. Claudia was considering taking the first vows that would lead to her novitiate, a prospect that pleased him less, but he knew that she had been born with as stubborn a streak as his own, and that to try to thwart her would merely strengthen her resolve. Mario had spent the time ensuring that San Gimignano, now under the sober and reformed control of his old comrade Roberto, and its territory, no longer posed a threat, and that the last pockets of Pazzi resistance had been weeded out. Monteriggioni was safe, and after the victory celebrations had been concluded, Mario's condottieri were allowed a well-earned furlough, using it according to their tastes by spending time with their families, or drinking, or whoring, but never neglecting their training. And their squires kept their weapons sharp and their armour free from rust, as the masons and carpenters ensured that the fortifications of both town and castle were well maintained. To the north, the external threat that might have been posed by France was in abeyance, since King Louis was busy getting rid of the last of the English invaders and facing up to the problems the Duke of Burgundy was causing him, while to the south, Pope Sixtus IV, a potential ally of the Pazzi, was too busy promoting his relatives and supervising the construction of a magnificent new chapel in the Vatican to give much thought to interference in Tuscany. Mario and Ezio had had many and long conversations, however, regarding the threat that they knew had not disappeared.
"I must tell you more of Rodrigo Borgia," Mario told his nephew. "He was born in Valencia,
but studied law in Bologna and has never returned to Spain, since he is better placed to pursue his ambitions here. At the moment he is a prominent member of the Curia in Rome, but his sights are always set higher. He is one of the most powerful men in all Europe, but he is more than a cunning politician within the church. He lowered his voice. Rodrigo is the leader of the Order of the Templars. Ezio felt his heart turn over in his body. That explains his presence at the murder of my poor father and my brothers. He was behind it.
Yes, and he won't have forgotten you, especially as it was largely thanks to you that he lost his power base in Tuscany. And he knows the stock you come from, and the danger you continue to pose him. Be fully aware, Ezio, that he will have you killed as soon as he gets the chance.
Then I must stand against him if I ever wish to be free.
He must remain in our sights, but we have other business nearer home first, and we have stayed our hand long enough. Come to my study.
They made their way from the garden where they had been walking into an inner room of the castle at the end of a corridor that led from the map room. It was a quiet place, dark without being gloomy, book-lined, and more like the room of an accademico than a military commander. Its shelves also contained artifacts that looked as if they might have come from Turkey or Syria, and volumes that Ezio could see from the writing on their spines were written in Arabic. He had asked his uncle about them, but received only the vaguest of replies. Once there, Mario unlocked a chest and from it drew a leather document wallet from which he took a sheaf of papers. Among them were some Ezio recognized immediately.
"Here is your father's list, my boy. Though I should not call you that any more, for you are a man now, and a full-blooded warrior. And to it I have added the names you told me of in San Gimignano."
He looked at his nephew and handed him the document.
"It is time for you to begin your work."
"Every Templar on it shall fall to my blade," said Ezio, evenly. His eye lit on the name of Francesco de Pazzi. "Here, with him, I will start. He's the worst of the clan, and fanatical in his hatred of our allies, the Medici."
"You are right to say so," Mario agreed. "So, you will make your preparations for Florence?"
"That is my resolve."
"Good. But there is more you must learn if you are to be fully equipped. Come."
Mario turned to a bookcase and touched a hidden button set into its side. On silent hinges it swung out and opened to reveal a stone wall beyond, on which a number of square slots had been marked out. 5 were filled, the rest were empty. Ezio's eyes gleamed as he saw it. The 5 filled spaces were occupied with pages of the Codex.
"I see you recognize what this is," said Mario, "and I'm not surprised. After all, there is the page your father left you, which your clever friend in Florence managed to decode, and these which Giovanni managed to find and translate before he died."
"And the one I took from Vieri's body," added Ezio. "But its contents are still a mystery."
"Alas, you are right. I am not the scholar your father was, though with every page that is added, and with the help of the books in my study, I am getting closer to unravelling the mystery. Look, do you see the way the words cross from one page to the next, and how the symbols join?"
Ezio looked hard, an eerie feeling of remembrance flooding his brain, as though a hereditary instinct was reawakening. And with this, the scrawls on the pages of the Codex seemed to come alive, their intentions untwisting in front of his eyes. "Yes. And there seems to be part of a picture of some sort underneath it. Look, it's like a map."
Giovanni, and now I, managed to make out what appears to be a kind of prophecy written across these pages. But what it refers to, I have yet to learn. Something about a piece of Eden. It was written long ago by an assassin like us, whose name appears to have been Altair. And there is more. He goes on to write of something hidden beneath the earth, something as powerful as it is old. But we have yet to discover what.
"Here is Vieri's page," said Ezio. "Add it to the wall."
"Not yet.
I will copy it before you go, but take the original to your friend in Florence with a brilliant mind. He need not know the full picture, at least what there is of it so far, and indeed it may be dangerous for him to have such knowledge. Later, Vieri's parchment will join the others on this wall, and we will be a little closer to deciphering the mystery.
What of the other pages?
They are yet to be rediscovered, said Mario. Do not concern yourself, for you must concentrate on the undertaking you have immediately before you.
Chapter 8. Ezio had preparations to make before he left Monteriggioni. He had much more to learn, at his uncle's side, of the assassin's creed, the better to equip himself for the task that faced him. There was also the need to ensure that it would be at least relatively safe for him in Florence, and there was the question of where he might lodge, since Mario's spies within the town had reported that his family palazzo had been closed and boarded up, though it remained under the protection and guard of the Medici family, and so had been left unmolested. Several delays and setbacks made Ezio increasingly impatient until, one morning in March, his uncle told him to pack his bags.
"It's been a long winter," Mario said.
"Too long," put in Ezio.
"But now all is settled," continued his uncle. "And I would remind you that meticulous preparation accounts for most victories. Now, pay attention. I have a friend in Florence who has arranged a secure lodging for you not far from her own house."
"Who is she, uncle?"
Mario looked furtive. "Her name is of no consequence to you, but you have my word that you can trust her as much as you would trust me. In any case, she is presently away from the town. If you have need of help, get in touch with your old housekeeper, Annetta, whose address has not changed and who now works for the Medici. But it would be best if as few people as possible in Florence knew of your presence there. There is, however, one person you must contact, though he isn't easy to reach. I've written his name down here. You must ask around for him discreetly. Try asking your scientific friend while you're showing him the codex page, but don't let him know too much for his own good. And here, by the way, is the address of your lodgings."
He handed Ezio two slips of paper and a bulging leather pouch.
"And 100 florins to get you started, and your travelling papers, which you will find in order. The best news of all is that you may set off tomorrow."
Ezio used the short time left to ride to the convent to take his leave of his mother and sister, to pack all his essential clothing and equipment, and to say goodbye to his uncle and the men and women of the town who had been his companions and allies for so long. But it was with a joyful and determined heart that he saddled his horse and rode forth from the castle gates at dawn the following morning. It was a long but uneventful day's ride, and by dinner time he was settled in his new quarters and ready to reacquaint himself with the city which had been his home all his life, but which he had not seen for so long. But this wasn't a sentimental return, and once he had found his feet again and permitted himself one sad walk past the facade of his old family home, he made his way straight to Leonardo da Vinci's workshop, not forgetting to take Vieri de Pazzi's page of the Codex with him. Leonardo had expanded into the property to the left of his own since Ezio had gone away, a vast warehouse with ample room for the physical results of the artist's imaginings to take shape. Two long trestle tables ran from one end of the place to the other, lit by oil lamps and by windows set high in the walls. Leonardo had no need of prying eyes. On the tables, hanging from the walls, and scattered, partly assembled, in the middle of the room, were a confusing number of devices, machines, and bits of engineering equipment, and pinned to the walls were hundreds of drawings and sketches. Among this pandemonium of creativity, half a dozen assistants busied and scuttled, overseen by the slightly older, but no less attractive, Agnolo and Innocento. Here, there was a model of a wagon, except that it was round, bristled with weapons, and was covered with an armoured canopy in the shape of a raised cooking pot lid, at the top of which was a hole through which a man might stick his head to ascertain what direction the machine was going in. There, the drawing of a boat in the shape of a shark, but with an odd tower on its back. More oddly still, it looked from the drawing as if the boat was sailing under water. Maps, anatomical sketches showing everything from the working of the eye to coitus to the embryo in the womb, and many others which it was beyond Ezio's imagination to decipher, crowded all available wall space, and the samples and clutter piled on the tables reminded Ezio of the organized chaos he remembered from his last visit here, but multiplied 100-fold. They were precisely figured images of animals, from the familiar to the supernatural, and designs for everything from water pumps to defensive walls. But what caught Ezio's eye most was hanging low from the ceiling. He had seen a version of it before, he remembered, as a smallish model, but this looked like a half-scale mock-up of what might one day be a real machine. It still looked like the skeleton of a bat, and some kind of durable animal skin had been stretched tightly over the frames of two wooden projections. Nearby was an easel with some paperwork attached to it. Among the notes and calculations, Ezio read, "Spring of horn or of steel fastened upon wood of willow encased in reed. The impetus maintains the birds in their flying course during such time as the wings do not press the air, and they even rise upwards. If a man weighed 200 pounds and is at point N, and raises the wing with his block, which is 150 pounds, with power amounting to 300 pounds, he would raise himself with two wings." It was all Greek to Ezio, but at least he could read it. Agnolo must have transcribed it from Leonardo's impenetrable scrawl. In that moment, he saw Agnolo looking at him, and hastily turned his attention elsewhere. He knew how secretive Leonardo liked to be. Presently, Leonardo himself arrived from the direction of the old studio and bustled up to Ezio, embracing him warmly. "My dear Ezio, you're back. I'm so glad to see you. After all that's happened, we thought..." But he let the sentence hang there and looked troubled. Ezio tried to lighten his mood again. "Look at this place. Of course I can't make head or tail of any of it, but I suppose you know what you're doing. Have you given up painting?" "No," said Leonardo, "just following up on other things that have caught my attention." "So I see. And you've expanded. You must be prospering. The past 2 years have been good to you." But Leonardo could see both the underlying sadness and the severity that had settled in Ezio's face now. "Perhaps," said Leonardo. "They leave me alone. I imagine they think I'll be useful to whoever wins absolute control one day. And not that I imagine anyone ever will." He changed. "But what of you, my friend?" Ezio looked at him. "There will be time, I hope, one day to sit down and talk over all that has happened since we last met. But now I need your help again." Leonardo spread his hands. "Anything for you. I have something to show you which I think will interest you." "Then you had better come to my studio. It is less busy there." Once back in Leonardo's old quarters, Ezio produced the codex page from his wallet and spread it on the table before them. Leonardo's eyes widened with excitement. "You remember the first one?" asked Ezio. "How could I forget?" The artist gazed at the page. "This is most exciting. May I?"
"Of course."
Leonardo studied the page carefully, running his fingers over the parchment. Then, drawing paper and pens towards him, he began to copy the words and symbols down. Almost immediately, he was darting to and fro, consulting books and manuscripts, absorbed. Ezio watched him work with gratitude and patience. "This is interesting," said Leonardo. "Some quite unknown languages here, at least to me, but they do yield a kind of pattern." "Yes. There's a gloss here in Aramaic which makes things a bit clearer." He looked up. "You know, taking this with the other page, you'd almost think they were part of a guide, on one level, at least. A guide to various forms of assassination. But of course, there's far more to it than that, though I have no idea what. I just know that we're only scratching the surface of what this may have to reveal. We'd need to have the whole thing complete. But you've no idea where the other pages are?"
"None."
"Or how many in the complete volume?"
"It is possible that may be known."
"Aha," said Leonardo.
secrets. Well, I must respect them. But then his attention was caught by something else. But look at this. Ezio looked over his shoulder but could see nothing but a succession of closely grouped, wedge-shaped symbols. What is it? I can't quite make it out, but if I'm right, this section contains a formula for a metal or an alloy that we know nothing of, and that, logically, should possibly exist. Is there anything else? Yes, the easiest bit to decipher. It's basically the blueprint for another weapon, and it seems to complement the one you already have. But this one we'll have to make from scratch. What kind of weapon? Fairly simple, really. It's a metal plate encased in a leather bracer. You'd wear it on your left forearm, or your right if you were left-handed like me, and use it to ward off blows from swords or even axes. The extraordinary thing is that although it's evidently very strong, the metal we're going to have to cast is also incredibly light. And it incorporates a double-bladed dagger, spring-loaded like the first. Do you think you can make it? Yes, though it will take a little time. I haven't much of that. Leonardo pondered. I think I have all I need here, and my men are skilled enough to forge this. He thought for a moment, his lips moving as he made calculations. It will take 2 days, he decided. Come back then and we'll see if it works. Ezio bowed. Leonardo, I am most grateful, and I can pay you. I am grateful to you. This codex of yours expands my knowledge. I fancied myself an innovator, but I find much in these ancient pages to intrigue me. He smiled and murmured almost to himself. And you, Ezio, cannot guess how indebted I am to you for showing them to me. Let me see any more that you may find. Where they come from is your business. I am only interested in what they contain, and that no one else outside your inner circle, apart from me, should know about them. That is all the recompense I require. That is indeed a promise. Grazie. Until Friday, then, at sunset? Until Friday. Leonardo and his assistants discharged their commission well. The new weapon, though it was defensive in application, was extraordinarily useful. Leonardo's younger assistants mock-attacked Ezio, but using real weapons, including double-handed swords and battle axes, and the wrist plate, light as it was and easy to wield, easily deflected the heaviest blows. This is an amazing armament, Leonardo. Indeed. And it may well save my life. Let's hope you get no more scars like the one across the back of your left hand, said Leonardo. That is a last souvenir from an old friend, said Ezio. But now I need one more piece of advice from you. Leonardo shrugged. If I can help you, I will. Ezio glanced over at Leonardo's assistants. Perhaps in private? Follow me. Back in the studio, Ezio unwrapped the slip of paper Mario had given him and handed it to Leonardo. This is the person my uncle told me to meet. He told me it would be no good to try to find him directly. But Leonardo was staring at the name on the paper. When he looked up, his face was filled with anxiety. Do you know who this is?
I read the name. La Volpe? I guess it's a nickname.
The Fox, yes. But do not speak it aloud or in public. He is a man whose eyes are everywhere, but who himself is never seen. Where might I find him? It is impossible to say, but if you wanted to make a start, and be very careful, you should try the district of the Mercato Vecchio. But every thief who isn't either in jail or on the gallows hangs out there. I told you you'd need to be careful. Leonardo looked round as if he were being overheard. I might be able to get word to him. Go and look for him tomorrow after Vespers. Perhaps you will be fortunate. Perhaps not. Despite his uncle's warning, there was one person in Florence whom Ezio was determined to see again. In all the time of his absence, she had never been far from his heart, and now the pangs of love had increased with the knowledge that she was not far away. He could not take too many risks in the city. His face had changed, become more angular,
as he had grown both in experience and years, but he was still recognisable as Ezio. His hood helped, allowing him to disappear in a crowd, and he wore it low. But he knew that although the Medici now held sway, the Pazzi had not had all their teeth drawn. They were biding their time, and they would remain vigilant. Of those two things, he was certain. Just as he was certain that if they caught him unawares, they would kill him, Medici or no Medici. Nevertheless, the following morning he could no more prevent his feet taking the way to the Calfucci mansion than he could have flown to the moon. The main street doors stood open, revealing the sunlit courtyard beyond. And there she was, slimmer, possibly taller, her hair up, no longer a girl, but a woman. He called her name. When she saw him, she turned so pale he thought she was going to faint. But she rallied, said something to her attendant to make her go away, and came out to him, her hands outstretched. He drew her quickly out of the street into the secluded shelter of an archway nearby, whose yellow stones were festooned with ivy. He stroked her neck, and noticed that the thin chain to which his pendant was attached was still around her neck, though the pendant itself was hidden in her bosom. "Ezio," she cried. "Christina, what are you doing here?" "I'm here on my father's business."
"Where have you been? I've had no word of you for 2 years."
"I have been away, also on my father's business."
"They said you must be dead. And your mother and sister."
"Fate dealt with us differently." He paused. "I could not write, but you have never left my thoughts." Her eyes, which had been dancing, suddenly clouded and looked troubled. "What is it, Carissima?" he asked.
"Nothing."
She tried to break free. He would not let her.
"Clearly it's something. Tell me."
She met his eyes, and her own filled with tears.
"Oh, Ezio, I'm engaged to be married."
Ezio was too taken aback to answer. He let go of her arms, realizing that he was holding her too tightly, hurting her. He saw the lonely furrow he had to plough, stretching ahead of him.
"It was my father," she said. "He kept on and on at me to choose. You were gone. I thought you were dead."
"Then my parents began to entertain visits from Manfredo Tarzenta. You know, the son of the Bullion people. They moved here from Lucca soon after you left Florence."
"Oh, God, Ezio, they kept asking me not to let the family down, to make a good match while I still could. I thought I'd never see you again, and now—"
She was interrupted by a girl's voice crying out in panic at the end of the street, where there was a little square. Christina became instantly tense.
"That's Ginetta. Do you remember her?"